As you're listening to me, Daisy, Apple's iPhone disassembly robot, is dismantling an iPhone into lots of recyclable parts. That's how Apple recovers more materials than conventional recycling methods. Thanks, Daisy. There's more to iPhone.
It's that time of the year. Your vacation is coming up. You can already hear the beach waves, feel the warm breeze, relax, and think about work. You really, really want it all to work out while you're away. Monday.com gives you and the team that peace of mind. When all work is on one platform and everyone's in sync, things just flow. Wherever you are, tap the banner to go to Monday.com.
Welcome to the Game Podcast. I'm Gabriel Marcotti, and this week I'm joined by Patty Barkley, Ben Smith, and from a secret location somewhere in the southwest of England, it's Matthew Syed. Today we'll be focusing on the stunning Barcelona win, the somewhat improving England, and of course, that wonderful mess we like to call FIFA. Well, why don't we start at the home of football, shall we? Wembley. Barcelona, emphatic victory, I think we can say, Paddy.
Oh, yes. The most beautiful victory I've seen. It was the 25th European final that I've... European Champions Cup or League final that I've seen. And by far the most beautiful, by far the most satisfying, by far the most sporting. Just in every way lit up the whole world, really, as far as I'm concerned, as a football enthusiast.
Paddy, I'm just curious, because you were saying before it was your second happiest day in football. Can ask the happiest?
Well, it's close. When Dundee won the championship in April 1962, that takes a lot of beating, but nothing since then has given me remotely as much pleasure as Saturday night. I just thought it was a vindication of all I believe in football, and I just almost feel that my football soul can die now. My football soul can drift away. It's happened.
Matthew, are you as happy as Paddy is today? Are you as present on the Barcelona bandwagon?
I couldn't agree more than Paddy. Beautifully expressed, eloquently done. I was moved almost, and I am more than happy to admit this, to tears by what I saw. I've watched Barcelona consistently in La Liga and elsewhere over recent seasons, and they have played the most sublime football. This took it to extraordinary levels. It was the comprehension of time and space of all of the players, really, with the possible exception of Mascherano, but particularly Iniesta, Xavi and Messi, was almost beyond description. It was remarkable, truly remarkable, to see a team as accomplished as Manchester United unable to get the ball, to get possession. They were outclassed, outmanoeuvred, outthought. And I agree with Paddy too that it was played in the right spirit, and perhaps the greatest tribute to this team was when Puyol deferred to Abidal when the trophy was lifted. I thought that summarised not just the philosophy of the club, but capped an astonishing evening. And Paddy said it was one of the great football matches. For me, this Barcelona team has taken sport to new levels. Mm.
All right, Ben, can you top this hyperbole, or do you want to play devil's advocate and talk about, hey guys, you know what? Some of you are the same people who were skewering and crucifying them for all the cheating, supposed cheating in the semifinal against Real Madrid. I'm sure Jose Mourinho doesn't feel that way, does he, Ben? Or will you join in the celebration?
Well, I think horses for courses. I think you have to play what's in front of you, and I think had that semi-final not been against Mourinho's Madrid, we wouldn't have seen Barcelona resorting to those kind of tactics. I think just to get away from that, I'm afraid I'm going to join on this bandwagon. It was wonderful to watch, to see a side do that on the big occasion, to pull it all together, to be just so tight knit as a team, to keep the ball the way they did, and their work rate off the ball as well. When they lose the ball is the thing that people forget with Barcelona. It's just fantastic to see players like Messi, Xavi running, chasing, doing all the hard work, and then when they get the ball they're just irresistible.
And where, May I just add, well said, Ben. It was Real Madrid who were the cheats in the Bernabeu, not Barcelona.
Right, I'm going to send Mourinho around to your house if you don't behave, Paddy. But okay, since I'm going to have to then clearly put on the devil's advocate straitjacket here, and I think it needs to be a straitjacket given what I'm about to say, as wonderful and as sublime as Barcelona were, could there not be an argument, Paddy, that they certainly fluffed at least four or five chances that I can recall in the game where they could have put the ball away and probably should have put the ball away. And also, Edwin van der Sar, I know we all celebrate him, but I think we have to say this. I think he'd want us to because he wants us to treat him as a professional and, you know, certainly at fault on the first goal and on the Messi goal as well. You put all those things together, maybe a better night from van der Sar, those missed chances, and it's still 1-1, or am I just talking rubbish and purposely trying to play devil's advocate here?
A bit of both, Gav, I think. I think, yes, you could certainly say that their victory should have been more emphatic. It wasn't until after Villa had scored that you realised that the day was on the side of the Angels, but not that Manchester United are devils. But I think, yes, I mean, you could. I don't think either of Van der Sar's things could be classed as blunders because, I mean, there was an element of immobilization. I mean, Pedro's goal was just, I mean, an incredible piece of skill. The Messi shot was hit so early. But, yes, there was an element of culpability. I think also in Messi's goal, the main guy at fault was Vidic, who seemed more interested in protecting his testicles than closing down the shot, which was unforgivable unprofessionalism, I must say. But yes, you could also, to a lesser extent, fault van der Sar.
Syed, I want to ask you about a guy you mentioned briefly before. And that's Javier Mascherano, because, we talked about how great Barcelona have been this season, and obviously when they have Puyol and Pique at center half, it's an accomplished situation. It's an accomplished combination. But the fact of the matter is that here you have a guy who is 5 feet, 8 inches tall, who's a central midfielder, and so, you know, the nature of his game is such that his athletically he's all about stamina rather than quickness. Who's not a good header of the ball at all. Who's tackling, obviously the tackling in midfield is different than you do at the back. And even against a guy like that, Manchester United can only manage one shot on goal. Is this to say more about United's deficiencies, or do we maybe exaggerate the specialization in football? And ultimately, a guy like Mascherano, if he's intelligent, even though he's 5'8", can play centre half.
Well, I mean, two bits to that. I mean, I think that Manchester United were not deficient. They were only deficient in one very specific sense, that they are the best team in the country. One of the best teams in the world, but they were inadequate because they were up against the greatest team that's ever played football. On Mascherano, I thought he was the weak link, really, in Barcelona. I know he was playing out of position, but the remarkable thing about Barcelona, the stunning thing, is the way that they anticipate each other's movement so that whenever they are passing the ball, it is moving into a position of space where a teammate is about to arrive at. And it made the Manchester United attempt to close them down almost a comical dance into nowhere, because whenever the Manchester United moved close, the ball was already moving off. And Mascherano, I think because he arrived at the club relatively late, after most of the others had grown up together at La Masia, he's just unaware of where they are, and therefore when he got the ball, other than one dart upfield where he actually made it into the perimeter of the Manchester United penalty area, by and large he was playing high ball. He was actually hoofing it up the pitch. He was very rarely doing the very short passing, certainly not as successfully as the Barcelona team. So I think that says a lot about how this Barcelona team has grown up together, and therefore they comprehend each other intentions in a way that we've never seen in other teams before.
Absolutely. May I also say at this point that if Barcelona had been worried about Mascherano, they would simply have swapped him with Busquets.
Yeah, but Paddy, sorry if I jump in there, but remember, Because Pepe addressed his very point a while back. You know, the plan B, of course, was Busquets, and it seemed more logical because of his size. But what they found when they put Mascherano in midfield, the passing just completely breaks down.
That's what I was just going to say. But if they'd been worried about the back, they could quite easily have addressed that. They reckoned that, I mean, it's quite interesting, the team sheet I was given had Mascherano in midfield and Busquets at the back. I didn't think they'd line up that way, and they didn't. But the performance of Busquets was fantastic.
Yes.
I mean, he is the one cheat in that team. I agree, possibly Alves, you could argue. But Busquets is an absolute shocker for a boy of his age. But what a player. I think Piqué and Busquets emerged as on the verge of greatness on Saturday, and the way, I mean, for Busquets to be the defensive midfield player, the Keane or the Makélélé, but to play like he does, I mean, I've never seen front sweeping like it. He was just majestic, and even though Rooney playing in his space was by far Manchester United's best player, he still emerged triumphant.
Just to go back to that Mascherano talk. I mean, in the first 10 minutes, I think was only the real time that Manchester United tested him.
That's when they were hoofing it.
Yeah, well, basically, yeah. He got caught under the ball twice, and Rooney almost got through on one occasion. There was a mix-up with a goalkeeper where Valdes had to clear it. You know, unfortunately, Manchester United didn't see the ball for the rest of the half, but on those two occasions, there was basically the long ball caught Mascherano out. They weren't able to do that again, but, you know, there are ways. I think as soon as the ball gets into midfield, if you let Barcelona get it into the feet of Busquets from the back, if you allow the goalkeeper to roll it to the midfield, then you don't see the ball again. I think the only way to put them under pressure, perhaps, is to try and stop that easy pass at the very start of the move, get into them there, make them go long, and then maybe you have a chance. But
Man United started very well in that sense, didn't they?
Yeah.
I can't just say that I just so agree with what Paddy said about Busquets and Pique. I know this eulogy is becoming probably a little seemingly eternal, but the only place I disagree is I think they've arrived at greatness. I mean, Pique was just astonishingly dominant at the back, and Busquets was brilliant, absolutely superb with his passing and his comprehension of where he needed to be at pretty much every pivotal moment in that match. But given that they've now won the World Cup and they've won the Champions League twice, you know, I just feel that they probably deserve that epithet of greatness now.
Syed, we probably saw, well, we think almost definitely saw the last of Edwin van der Sar. We may have seen the last of Paul Scholes in a United shirt. You know, we often talk about sort of when great players walk away from the game. Do you walk away at your peak? When do you know what the appropriate time is to walk away? The one piece of wisdom I got from Carlo Ancelotti was that, you know, the key thing is try to make sure that when you do walk away, you do it because you choose to walk away and not because your body or others choose it for you. Are they leaving at the right time?
Yeah, it's always difficult, isn't it, for a sportsman to walk away from the thing that he loves. And we often see in sports beyond football athletes wanting to come back when they're clearly past their best. But they've probably got the timing right. I think Edwin van der Sar, just a smidgen worse than Schmeichel, which is a tremendous accolade because Schmeichel was fantastic and a tremendous servant at Manchester United. And Scholes, it's interesting that... And Xavi was interviewed about the players that he most admired. It was a tremendous newspaper interview not so long ago. He said he apparently almost jumped off his seat to say, well, Paul Scholes, we think that he was somebody who would have fitted in magnificently to the Barcelona team. And actually, when Guardiola was interviewed before the final, they said, if you were to have one Manchester United player in your team, who would it be? And again, unhesitatingly, he said Scholes. So I think that is a tribute to just what a great player Scholes has been.
Paddy, I'll give you the last word on Scholes since this was brought up. You've always been a big fan of his tackling.
I'm not. I always think Scholes has been overpraised, really, in England. I don't think that he's remotely comparable with Xavi or even Iniesta. Hasn't got the mobility of Iniesta, hasn't got the brain of Xavi. He has now the brain of Xavi, but for most of his career he didn't. I mean, I can remember when he retired from international football. I mean, England didn't collapse as if poleaxed. simply because he'd never been thought of as that important a player. In the latter years of his career, it became not just fashionable to praise him, but impossible to criticise him. He was a very, 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 very good player, but not a great one.
From the sublime to England. There used to be a time when we talked about how excited the media were for England and the new course and Fabio Capello. Now it seems that they're just counting down the time till after Euro 2012 when he can leave. And I think they used to say an Englishman will take over. Then most recently it's a person with a British attitude who speaks good English, because of course they're realizing that the pool of candidates has narrowed to one, and his name is Harry Redknapp. But I want to check something out. I mean, this England side, they topped the group. They're playing Switzerland. 9 goals scored in 4 outings, 1 goal allowed. This qualifying group is not that bad. Bulgaria, Montenegro, Wales, okay, by the last one. Patty, why is everybody so down and so unenthusiastic? Is it because all the star players are turning their backs on their countries?
Yeah, well, I think there's an element of that. And I think also it's a hangover from the profoundly disappointing performances in the World Cup. I think people, Capello's in a way, I don't know if he still cares about what the English think of him, but he'll be judged in a 2.5-week period in next summer in Poland and Ukraine, because everybody sort of takes it for granted because of the way European football is configured now that England will qualify, and rightly so, which obviously they will. They've done it competently, as they did last time under Capello. The qualifying series last time for the World Cup, you know, with Croatia being beaten 9-2 on aggregate, I mean, could hardly have been bettered. Croatia at their peak, may I say, or just past it. So, I mean, yes, qualifying's not a problem. And I think the reason that we're a bit downbeat about England now is that we're saying, well, we've seen all this before. It's in the finals that we want to play well, not in qualifying. Now,
Paddy, isn't this a kind of wider thing with international football? Isn't there a growing apathy towards international football outside of the World Cup? You look at the players who are retiring early and the players who aren't...
Go back to Paul Scholes.
Oh, exactly. Yeah. I just get the feeling
sorry if I jump in here, Ben, but you're talking about the players who are retiring early, okay?
I know.
Tell me a worthwhile player who's not an absolute...
But I don't think that's what I'm saying.
Alan Shearer did it, but I think we gave him a pass because of his situation.
Sure, but there was
but
a
these
time
other people,
who
cares?
No, I agree with that, but...
Paul Robinson, go back to your pig pen.
But Gab, that's not what I'm saying. I'm not saying it's key to England, but I'm saying people don't care about international football. It's not their priority anymore. I don't believe it's the spectator's priority. I don't believe it's the player's priority. When you see the things you see on Saturday night, that is the top of the game now. That's where the priorities are for players, I believe. The top of the club game is now... More, players want to play that kind of football more than they do international football outside of World Cups.
Syed, 75,000 people on average pack Wembley to watch England play, which I find absolutely extraordinary. If that's the case, then how does that statistic stack up with what notoriously anti-English Ben Smith has just been saying?
Anti-international football, actually.
Yeah, I think Ben... I would say Ben is wrong on this. I think that the significance, cultural and sporting, of the World Cup has risen and continued to rise in recent years. All that's happened is that the Champions League has risen in prestige rather more quickly, so the gap is closing between the two. But
I did qualify what I said by outside of World Cups. I believe there's apathy towards international football.
The World Cup and the European Championships, of course, the apex of the international agenda and timetable, they, in not just sporting terms but in cultural terms, are of almost infinite significance. If you just look at the way that the nation responded here, but also the various nations around the world for which football is a national sport, which is most nations, it is a hugely unifying national shared collective experience. It dominates the news. I mean, back in 66, when we won the World Cup, it was a big national occasion, but a relatively small media story. Today, you know, the group matches dominate the agenda, and it is the main aspect of the national conversation. I mean, to say that
I agree with you on that, Matthew. I'm saying outside of World Cup, I'm saying a World Cup is a different kettle of fish completely. I couldn't agree more with you. Of course, it's the biggest story going. Of course, everyone puts flags in their cars and goes crazy. I'm saying outside of that, I don't think people care. I don't think people care that England are playing Switzerland. I don't think. Do you?
Only in the sense that they need to qualify in order to get to these big, grand international occasions like the European Championships and the World Cup. So, and of course, you just need to see the fact that Wembley is pretty much always packed out and so on.
Do you think the players care about playing Switzerland at this time of the season in an international game?
I still think that players recognise the underlying truth that for them to take their place in the, if you like, the iconography of a nation, the World Cup is still the single most persuasive way to do that. You know, Bobby Moore, Bobby Charlton, the way that they form part of our identity, that is something I think players understand and crave. Because, of course, when you're playing for a club, you're playing for a relatively narrow caucus. You're playing for that particular fan base. When you play for your country, you are, as it were, the representatives. I mean, it's an odd phenomenon, this, but there is a sense in which you're a representative of the entire people, and I do think the players recognise its significance.
I'd go even further than Matthew and perhaps suggest that, especially in England, where, you know, I think we all know this, you haven't really won anything of note in a very long time. That, you know, there's still an iconography around, you know, the 96 team with Terry Venables, which, correct me if I'm wrong, only, you know, didn't actually win a game after the group stages. And
the train is now approaching. Junction at platform. Passengers, airport, please stay on board. Next stop, road station.
iOS helps you control which apps you share your exact location with. There's more to iPhone.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 50% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition Smart Bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at a Sleep Number store or sleepnumber.com.
It's kind of, you know, I think this does matter to a lot of people. Also, because the other interesting phenomenon is I'm looking at these people who've been called up for England. And, okay, apart from the defenders, you know, when it's Ferdinand and Terry and Ashley Cole, most of these other guys really haven't won much or don't really play for particularly interesting teams. So, you know, it's, if I'm Scott Parker or if I'm, you know, James Milner or Bobby Zamora, I can't really get uppity about England, can I? Because, you know, hey, Bobby Z, you play for Fulham. You know, nobody cares what you do week in, week out. You know, Scott Parker, you got relegated, even though you somehow won the Football Writers Award. I mean, hey, Paddy, you've been around international. Do you get the sense that we from the media, once the players are there, they actually mean something to them and they actually do want to win?
Well, it is late in the season. But I think that players such as Scott Parker, you know, it will. I saw him play in Wales in the last match, and I don't think there was any doubting his commitment or the fact that he saw this final phase of his career, now that he's free of injury and playing the best football of his life, as a way of really making his mark. And it was, you know, you didn't need to ask him how much playing for England meant to him. I mean, Lampard turns up, doesn't he? Time after time, he'll be there. Terry, Ferdinand, Cole, Johnson, the entire back five will be there, injury permitting. No, I think it should be a strong side. Yeah, Rooney, of course, is suspended. But I think it will. It does mean a lot to them. But saying that you know, one does become mentally jaded after a 10.5, 11-month season. And I suppose a summer without a tournament will do these guys a lot of good, yeah.
Of course, all this could have been fixed by adopting the Marcotti and early Platini plan of condensing all international football in 6 weeks to 2 months. But hey,
it's a great idea.
That's a whole other issue, yes. All right, let's move further down the food chain. We've had the sublime Champions League final. We've had England, da-da-da. Who wants to talk a little bit of FIFA? This podcast may well be outdated, given that as we're recording this today at 5 o'clock, Sepp Blatter is going to give a press conference and tell them and address the media. I presume he's going to answer back to Jack Warner's accusations. All right. I mean, I need to do a little recap for those who aren't as keen on the sinews of FIFA as Syed is. Basically, there's an election coming up. It's scheduled for June 1st. As it stands now, the election will go ahead. There were two candidates. One of them is Sepp Blatter, who has been FIFA president since 1998, and before that was general secretary of the organization. The other one was a man named Mohammed bin Hammam from Qatar, who is a very rich man involved with the Asian Football Confederation. Qatar. Rumors that, well, let's put it this way, people were very surprised when Qatar won the World Cup. Since then, Qatar and a man named Jack Warner, who is not is not a film mogul, but is a man from Trinidad, who heads CONCACAF, which is the North and Central American Confederation. He has been accused of facilitating bribes to a number of CONCACAF member nations, together with Mohammed bin Hammam. The pair of them were called before an ethics committee on Sunday, which ultimately suspended them from FIFA activities. In the interim, of course, they also accused Sepp Blatter of knowing about these bribes that they were going to pay. But the ethics committee on Sunday, which is headed by a very nice man from Namibia, who keeps saying Mr. Jack Warner instead of just Mr. Warner, found not much basis to the allegations. And since then, both Jack Warner and Mohammed bin Hammam have been extremely critical of FIFA and Sepp Blatter. Bin Hammam alleging that he's basically been set up as a fall guy to get him out of the way for the elections. And Jack Warner, in an incredible, I think it's fair to say, statement on his Facebook page, or it's not even his Facebook page, it's the Trinidad and Tobago Soca Warriors Facebook page. It really is worth reading. Makes an incredible string of allegations. Some of them may be libelous, so please go on his Facebook page and check them out. But we will be talking very carefully about some of them. Paddy, is that a fair summation of the circles of hell that we've descended into?
Very fair and very succinct. It's quite difficult to sort out the villains of the piece, isn't it? Since they all seem to be. They're all in a position to know. It's the first time ever that we've had such an outbreak of transparency. But of course it won't make any difference, because and I'm very surprised that nobody's talked about this, the failure of our own football association to put up a candidate in this election. If they had done, as I suggested they should, both in private conversations and articles in the Times, then we would now be having a totally, utterly discredited Sepp Blatter against a squeaky clean candidate supported by the English FA. They didn't need to provide one. I shouldn't think there's anyone good enough in the FA, but they could have backed any one of the people who were putting themselves
you
forward.
You could have backed Grant Wall, who would have made a better FIFA president.
Personally, I would have preferred Elias Figueroa.
Or Elias Figueroa, actually.
The very distinguished Chilean former central defender.
But sorry, but Ben is shaking his head furiously here. I think he wants to stick up for the FA.
No, I don't. I certainly don't want to stick up for the FA. What I do want to say is I think Blatter had this in the bag from the start. I don't think, unfortunately, I think the whole system, everyone who votes on this, I think Blatter is too powerful. I think he would have won this, whoever ran against him, Paddy.
I'm not saying for a minute, Ben, that the English FA or any dissident FA who nominated an alternative candidate would have won.
Sure.
But what this would have done is flushed out opposition, and we would then have had, of course, all the small football associations in the not only in the Caribbean but all over the world who rely upon Blatter's largesse would have continued to vote for him. Of course they would. But the others who don't, like the English FA, who don't have to rely on that, would be able to form a bloc that would be small in number but very, very large in power and equally capable of supplying the patronage so that the next election in 4 years' time won't simply be an anointing. See, at the moment, because the English FA didn't stand in this, there's absolutely no way that anything will change in the long term.
No, you're dead right.
I think you could also throw in the fact that, of course, the fact that the minute England didn't get the FA, the nomination, what happened, somebody, and I won't say who, but, it's a little northern, a small northern man who specializes in wreaking financial havoc on football clubs he claims to support, chucked David Dean, out the door immediately, because David Dean is supposedly a threat, because obviously having brains in that organization makes you a threat. But I wanted to get your view on this. Obviously, as a former Olympian, people, you may have a view on this because people have drawn parallels to the IOC moment a few years ago. And Warner's letter, and I will reveal a little something of what's in it. At one point, he accuses Sepp Blatter of making a similar payment to delegates, but not with his own money, but with FIFA money, and Michel Platini becoming very, very angry and agitated about this and telling Blatter he can't do it, and Jerome Valk, who, for those who don't know, is the general secretary of FIFA, and I think sort of a stereotypically French evil bureaucrat type with glasses, he tells Platini to shut it and that they'll find the money in the budget for it. The fact that Michel Platini, who I believe is the only head of a confederation who has been around for a little while and has not been implicated in anything, there's the fact that he has to now, I think he's got to come forward, he's got to say something, whether this is true or not. Could this be a mobilizing moment where maybe people can rally behind those elements that are clean and just undisputably clean and advise everybody who's been smeared even a little bit to just step aside for a while until they can establish their innocence?
Yes, it could be a watershed moment and a catalyst for change, although I thought that was something that could have happened during the bidding process for 2018 and 2022, which was so disreputable and surrounded by so many allegations, Panorama, Sunday Times and other media organs that I think come out of this very well for the scrutiny that they've applied. But again, it might not be. It's possible that it won't happen. I think the reason why there's a good chance that this will be a catalyst is that in the past, the allegations have come from outside FIFA and the hierarchy of closed ranks. Now the knives are out at the top of FIFA. Warner, the allegations are explosive. If they can be corroborated, they could be pretty devastating. And Blatter, as you say, press conference to respond to those allegations. But it is all becoming, the fissures at the top of FIFA are opening up. And I think there is a real chance now that the edifice of corruption that many of us have suspected for a long time will hose into view.
Okay, we talk about corruption here, and again, I guess I'll put on my Real Politic contrarian hat here for just one second. Leaving aside certain people who have already been found guilty. I mean, Jerome Valk, there's not an issue. He's the general secretary of FIFA. You can ask questions of Blatter and bring him back, but this is a man who, in 2004, of course, was involved in a horrible court case involving MasterCard and Visa, and as a result, the court ordered FIFA to pay a $60 million fine. And also the court found that Chuck Blazer, who is the main accuser of Jack Warner, was completely not a credible witness and evasive. This is all in the court documents. So these are some of the characters involved. But Blatter himself, I don't think there's anybody who believes that he personally profits from any of this. And the way it's been sort of outlined to me is FIFA brings a lot of money into the game, and they simply, and the way it works is patronage, which basically means is they will make development, they will steer some of their development money, some of their enormous budget that they get from the sale of World Cup rights to different parts of the world. And that, yeah, of course, maybe they look at who does favors for them or not. But you know what? That's kind of the way politics works in general. I mean, if your local MP is powerful and important, most likely he will be more effective for his constituents than some of those MPs that nobody's ever heard of. Syed, you stood for Parliament. Is this that different?
Well, just trying to unravel the different bits of the question. I mean, Blatter does benefit hugely.
How?
From FIFA. Well, it's pretty obvious. He enjoys very much being the head of a global organisation, which enables him to hobnob with powerful men and women, and he gets a huge amount of kudos and pleasure from the job. And the problem is that the allegation would be that he has turned a blind eye to allegations of corruption, backhanders, quid pro quos, all the allegations that are swirling around the organisation, because he owes his position to those people who may be cream skimming. In other words, the power relations in FIFA require that the person at the top indulges those who are cheating on the sport. And you're totally wrong to say that FIFA brings money into football. Football brings money into football. It's such a wonderful spectacle that people are prepared to watch. Now, FIFA doesn't monetize that. All it does is structure and sell the rights. But it's a damn easy product to sell.
Right, but FIFA then, I mean, they have things like the Gold Project and so on. They stage it. But put it this way. If some other entrepreneurs I could think of, if they were to stage the World Cup privately, they would stage the World Cup and then just divide the TV rights between the TV rights money between the countries that participate. FIFA goes and takes the TV monies and say, hey, you know, Montserrat, hey, Papua New Guinea, you know, you don't have a snowball's chance in hell of ever getting to the World Cup, but here's some development money for you so you can push football in those countries. Isn't that what Blatter might say?
Well, I mean, wonderful. I mean, what a fantastic guy he is. Remember that the Congress works, and each FA gets one vote. So making sure that you dispense some of the largesse in a rather more equal way is not particularly surprising. But you know, either way, you could say that FIFA is undermining its own product, because not only is it now looking to be utterly unfit for purpose, which could undermine commercial revenues in the long term, but it is unable to discharge the responsibilities that it has. I mean, giving $1 million willy-nilly, if that's the allegation, handing over laptops, people within FIFA taking kickbacks, that was the allegation from Panorama. That's cream skimming from the value that football is generating.
The Panorama, what you're talking about, those allegations were 12, 13 years ago, and they were settled in court. I mean, that's...
But the revelations that Jennings made in Panorama were credible. It was all circumstantial evidence. But any institution headed by somebody who had any desire for probity would have launched an independent investigation and opened up the internal documents of FIFA, would have made sure that the executive committee members had to reveal their bank accounts. We've had none of this at FIFA. Trying to play devil's advocate here is, I think, pretty difficult. FIFA are not fit for purpose.
Matthew, I'm with you. I think transparency is the word here. I mean, if they are...
That was Mohammed bin Hammam's word, transparency.
Sure.
Campaigned on that.
Look where it got him. I mean, but the problem is
you're a fan then.
No, but if there's nothing to hide, if Blatter is doing nothing wrong, if there's nothing to hide from everything they're doing, then tell us about it.
Well, after that FIFA conversation, the kind of quick hitting I would like to do is the paddling of flabby FIFA exco buttocks, but unfortunately we can't do that, so we'll have to do our own version. Joey Barton has not been offered a new contract by Newcastle because reportedly the club wants somebody younger and cheaper. Paddy, is this a wise decision?
Well, it probably is. He's overpaid. I reckon he gets about, I think he gets about £75,000 a week, and that's too much for Newcastle. They want to get somebody younger and cheaper. This is probably now is the time.
The identity of Chelsea's next manager is still shrouded in mystery. Matthew, you've been critical of Mr. Roman Abramovich in the past. If he hired you as one of his many consultants, say a bit like Goose Hiddink, what kind of stuff would you be telling him?
Well, if he asked my advice, I would...
And paid for it.
Yeah, well, that's an interesting... I would probably tell him to advise him to sell Chelsea, to sell some of the yachts that he owns, to hand the money back to the Russian people who were, in my view, totally ripped off by some of the shadiest privatizations of the Boris Yeltsin era.
Well, okay, Matthew,
quite,
I can tell...
Which isn't quite a football answer, but that's what I'll advise him to do.
Okay, I can tell you're a rubbish... You really are a rubbish consultant, because the key to being a good consultant is to tell the people who hire you exactly what they want to hear, and I'm sure that's not what he wants to hear. Big Sam Allardyce will reportedly be the next West Ham manager, and this is the real Sam Allardyce, not his Twitter alter ego. Ben, how will he get on with the unholy trinity of Karen Brady, David Gold, and David Sullivan? Could he really not do any better than the Hammers?
Answer that second question first. No, I don't think he could. Sacked by Blackburn, sacked by Newcastle. He's been offered work in the Middle East, but, you know, he's on 1.2 million a season here. He'll get a million if they go up. It's, you know, it's a decent job. He's not going to be popular with the fans, but, you know, I would back him to get them up. The unholy trinity, he can't say he doesn't know what he's getting himself in for.
He'll be more popular with me than their owners, tell you that much.
Me too.
One member of the Ferguson family had a good weekend, at least. It's Darren, whose Peterborough side won their playoff and promotion to the next level. Paddy, you know your Fergusons. Can Darren ever emulate Dad?
I think he can do very well at Peterborough. I mean, he had a terrible... He was pretty poor at Preston North End, who sacked him. But the old Peterborough magic has resumed, and I think that's because of the relationship he has with the chairman there, Darren McAntony, who's a bright boy, young, pots of money, and I think that they'll be a force in the championship next season. They won't. I'm not sure they'll go up, but I think they'll survive.
A very wise man once said that the definition of insanity is doing the same things over and over again and expecting different results. Matthew, with that in mind, should Wenger start doing something different, or should he simply revel in his insanity?
Well, I think it would be slightly insane to change too much. What he's achieved at Arsenal is fabulous. Terrific football, good results, although he hasn't won trophies, and he's done so without endangering the financial integrity of the club. But I think, like most fans, I would like to see him spend a bit of money in the summer and see whether or not he can lead them to a big trophy next season.
But you want him to stay?
Would I like Wenger to stay at Arsenal?
Well, no, just stay in London, hang out in North London, shop at Waitrose. Yes, of course, stay as Arsenal manager.
Would I like him to stay?
Yes. All right. Wilson Palacios has been linked to a move away from Spurs. Now, Ben, it kind of makes sense since they've got a half a billion defensive midfielders among them, of course, Sandro, Tom Huddleston, and Jermaine Genus. But they're going to get a lot less than they paid for him. Is this another one of those sort of Jermaine Defoe, Robbie Keane type Redknapp signings that probably didn't really benefit Spurs?
No, I'd agree with you. I think I don't doubt his quality. I think he can do a great job for someone, but they are going to lose on him big time. At the time, it looked like decent business, but they probably paid too much. I think Scott Parker coming in this summer is another likely move. And again, you wonder where Palacios fits in. But I think he can do a job for someone. But yeah, I agree with you. Harry hasn't done great out of that deal.
All right, boys and girls, that's all we've got time for this week. Remember, you can go to www.thetimes.co.uk. You'll find your news, your gossip, and all the analysis you need to take you through these dreary summer months with no sport whatsoever until Premier League football comes back in August. And of course, you can always follow us on Twitter. I'm on there at Mark Carty. And guess what? Ben Smith is on there too. Ben, what's your Twitter handle?
Ben_Smith_Times.
How original. Paddy's on there. Ollie Kay's on there. We all try to work hard. James Docker, one of my personal favorites. And of course, our boss, Tony Evans. So please indulge in that Twitter fest. And we'll be back next week for the final game podcast of the season. Till then, ta-ta.
As you're listening to me, Daisy, Apple's iPhone disassembly robot, is dismantling an iPhone into lots of recyclable parts. That's how Apple recovers more materials than conventional recycling methods. Thanks, Daisy. There's more to iPhone.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.